Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, January 13th, 2025 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week, I'll start with the From the Editor column, and then I'll read the cover story, followed by Points of Progress. Science and Nature is AWOL. What a surprise, right? So I'll read the explainer, then I'll follow up with the Home Forum and the Monitor's View. So, getting right into it, the From the Editor column is entitled, Policing That Looks Beyond Us Versus Them. This is written by Mark Sappenfield, the editor, and you can email him at editor@csmonitor.com. And he writes, I never fail to be amazed at how difficult we humans often make things for ourselves and others. After nearly 30 years in journalism, I have a strong conviction that, in many cases, the steps towards solutions really aren't all that much of a mystery. Yes, problems are difficult, and some, like climate change, are exceedingly so. Yet generally, if you ask around enough, smart people often agree on ways forward. Add a healthy dollop of common sense, some expertise, and an honest desire to help rather than have one's own way, and voila! Solutions emerge. I mention this because this week's cover story by Simon Montlake on new policing techniques in Columbus, Ohio is a perfect example. From one vantage point, the challenges of modern-day policing are severe. During this era of protest and discontent, where does one draw the line between protecting free speech and maintaining law and order? Often our emotions intervene on whatever side of the debate we fall. Then the question becomes one of one side against another. Freedom versus order, police versus protesters. Beyond that, there is the even thornier issue of race and policing. Racism, police tactics, punitive laws, crime rates, community violence, and cultural misunderstandings all come together in a toxic mix that has bubbled over into traumatic events that have reshaped the United States and the world. The problems can appear insurmountable. Struggling police departments seem burdened with addressing all the social ills the nation has not yet solved. Maybe there is another way. We often think us versus them is an inevitable fixture of our societies, and then we double down on that through policies and laws made from that view. The reality is that us versus them is only the inevitable fixture of our problems. The measures Simon highlights in Columbus are, in some ways, deceptively simple. The police department has created a unit that goes into protests to help maintain order by learning about what's happening in real time. In doing so, however, they aim to be friendlier, more approachable police presence. It is called the Columbus Police Dialogue Team, and if you were to distill its mission down to a word cloud, it might include words like talk, understand, coordinate, defuse, calm. We know different law enforcement tactics are needed for different situations, and we know no one tactic works every time. But we also know this general approach gets results. An article in next week's magazine will touch on Boston's historic drop in homicides. Causes are always multifaceted, but one inescapable element is Boston's decades-long commitment to community policing. In other words, Boston police have made a priority of getting out into communities and listening, understanding, and coordinating. Does this take long years of honest investment? Of course. So does virtually anything worth doing. Columbus hopes the nation is watching. If it is, we can be confident that what is on the horizon will be better than what has come before. That was the From the Editor column this week, written by Mark Sappenfield, who is an editor. And this week was entitled, Policing That Looks Beyond Us Versus Them. And now for the cover story. This week it's entitled, During Protests, Police Choose a Dialogue Over Force. In Columbus, Ohio, police are rethinking how to manage unruly crowds. Their dialogue unit could become a model for other U.S. cities. This is written by Simon Montlake, who is a staff writer, and there is that paragraph that says why we wrote this. It's got the heading of Innovation. American police often use force to manage unruly crowds. Reforms from Europe emphasize talking to protesters. U.S. cops are giving it a try. From Columbus, Ohio, under a fading late fall sun, protesters in support of the Palestinian cause are starting to gather in front of Ohio's white-columned state house. They arrive alone in twos or threes, wearing keffiyehs, sneakers, and puffer jackets. Most are carrying Palestinian flags and handmade signs protesting Israel's aggression. They've come to downtown Columbus on a Sunday afternoon, leaving the campus of Ohio State University to meet near the State House's frontispiece, a statue of President William McKinley, an Ohio son assassinated in 1901. The protest today follows a week of campus events on the conflict in Gaza organized by the group Students for Justice in Palestine. Around the corner, past the Holocaust Memorial Monument, three police cruisers are waiting. From the McKinley statue, they remain out of sight. But mingling among the demonstrators are four uniformed officers wearing powder blue police vests emblazoned with Columbus Police Dialogue. Janine Musa, a student leader wearing round tortoiseshell glasses and a black hoodie, is holding a bullhorn to her lips. "Don't talk to any cops, even the dialogue cops," she says, going on to announce the protest is about to start. Some have already talked with officers who have radioed the information to Sergeant Steve Dyer, the dialogue unit's team leader at the steps of the State House. He learns they plan to march north behind a black pickup truck as a protest on one of the city's main roads. Now, Sergeant Dyer can alert the 9-officer bicycle patrol that will help direct traffic during the demonstration. The cruisers will follow the protesters. At the same time, the dialogue team will continue to mingle among the crowd. There are only a few units in the United States specially trained for this type of policing. Columbus police try to ensure that marchers are able to exercise their rights to free speech and assembly. At the same time, they use engagement and dialogue with an aim to maintain peace and order. Their goal is to have their voices heard, Sergeant Dyer says. We will walk and work with those who are there to peacefully protest. His department's dialogue unit has made Columbus a testing ground for a new approach to managing public demonstrations and other mass events. It's been more of a one-way conversation in the past, says Robert Nagel, a deputy chief of police in Columbus who oversees the dialogue team. Officers would warn protest leaders not to break the law. Then, once that conversation was over, we returned to our command posts. Police officers are now trying to do more than issue warnings. Staying on the ground and walking with and talking to protesters, police hope to build legitimacy, a bridge of communication that could de-escalate potential conflicts. This kind of policing stems from a more nuanced understanding of crowd dynamics, researchers say. It seeks to measure how officers' words and deeds can steer participants towards peaceful self-expression. As word has spread of what Columbus is doing, the department has begun to train police officers from other cities in crowd management. In July, its dialogue officers worked outside the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee to help facilitate order and diffuse tensions during protests. Other law enforcement agencies have also been piloting new police approaches to protests and other public events, says Edward McGuire, a criminologist at Arizona State University who has studied how protesters perceive police. In a country with about 18,000 police agencies, reform is diffuse and uneven. What works in Columbus may not work in a small town. Other departments still rely on a militarized type of policing, especially during racial justice protests, he says. But Dr. McGuire sees signs that more departments are starting to rethink how to manage crowds. There's a groundswell of reform bubbling up within the profession, and that reform looks very promising. Columbus is a case study into these kinds of reforms. Still, the violent responses of its police department during the racial justice protests of 2020 still hover over it. The route of today's protest in support of Gaza will pass the same corner where demonstrations, some of them violent, took place in May 2020 after a white police officer in Minneapolis murdered George Floyd. Those events tapped a wellspring of racial tension in Columbus, say local activists. The demonstrations were animated by the pent-up frustrations of people who didn't trust Columbus's mostly white police force. As in many U.S. cities, the Columbus police were unprepared for the intensity and duration of the protests that followed. It was a destabilizing experience to try to maintain peace and order, many say, in a crowd directing its anger precisely at them. It also exposed a failure of civil leadership during a time of crisis, says Robert Meter, a police commander at the time. These riots hit overnight, and we were all caught by surprise. Many police officers working 12-hour shifts showed restraint in the face of insults and volleys of bricks and bottles. Black officers were often singled out for abuse. The intensity of what happened in 2020 was nothing like anything I experienced as a police officer before, says Sergeant Colin Straub, a black officer who worked the front lines. Still, police responded aggressively, using rubber bullets, pepper spray, tear gas, and other violent tactics against protesters. Dozens were injured, including those protesting peacefully. Police made 147 arrests and fired 1,370 rounds of munitions, according to a city-commissioned report. In July 2020, over 30 people filed a federal lawsuit against Columbus police, seeking damages for unnecessary brutality and violations of their constitutional rights. In December 2021, Columbus settled the lawsuit, paying out $5.75 million in damages. As part of the settlement, a federal judge barred Columbus police from using non-lethal force, including tear gas, pepper spray, rubber bullets, wooden pellets, and more on non-violent protesters. This case is the sad tale of police officers clothed with the awesome power of the state, run amok, wrote U.S. District Judge Algernon Marbley. His injunction against these tactics applied to police responses to acts of civil disobedience, including occupying sidewalks or streets or passively resisting police orders. The ruling rocked a department that was already in turmoil. Columbus Police Chief Thomas Quinlan was forced out in January 2021, and 100 of 1,900 city police officers accepted buyout offers, joining those who quit by the end of 2020. In June 2021, Mayor Andrew Genther, a Democrat who had clashed publicly with police leadership over the need for reform, appointed Elaine Bryant, a black deputy chief from Detroit, to head the department. She was tasked with maintaining peace and order during future demonstrations. After the fallout from 2020, nobody wanted to play riot cop again, especially since the court injunction made it legally perilous. Officers knew they needed a new playbook, but weren't sure where to look. Dwayne Mabry, now a department commander and trainer, had an idea. He knew the Seattle Police Department was also conducting a top-to-bottom review of its response to the 2020 George Floyd protests. Commander Mabry had been in contact with Lieutenant Jim Diamond, a veteran officer in Seattle who ran the mountain bike unit. Commander Mabry, then a sergeant, called Lieutenant Diamond to ask what Seattle was learning about crowd control. "We're going to see how they do it in Europe," he told him. "Maybe you can join us." He also gave his Columbus counterpart the name of a social psychologist from England who has some interesting new ideas that they were considering. Google him, he said. Clifford Stott has the blunt features, cropped hair, and furrowed brow of an English policeman, though he's never served. He grew up in a village outside London, dropped out of school at age 16, and joined protests against racism and far-right extremism. "I was anti-authoritarian, didn't like the police," he told a BBC radio show in 2020. After enrolling at a community college, he began to learn about crowd psychology. He went on to earn a PhD, studying how crowds and police behaved during the poll tax riots in London of 1990. Now a professor of social psychology at Keele University in England, Dr. Stott has become an international expert on how to manage crowds, advising police forces around the world. He fights against what he sees as old, flawed ideas about how crowds act. Many of these began to percolate in the late 19th century France, when authorities lived in fear of irrational mobs. Conservative theorists argued that individuals lost all sense of reason within a crowd. They believed emotions were contagious, so riots grew out of angry individuals spreading anger to the point of mass violence. By joining an organized crowd, a man descends several rungs in the ladder of civilization, wrote Gustave Le Bon in The Crowd, a Study of the Popular Mind, in 1895. Isolated, he may be a cultivated individual. In a crowd, he is a barbarian, that is, a creature acting by instinct. Balderdash, says Dr. Stott, decades of research into how individuals in crowds actually behave, as well as what drives them into disorder and violence, have debunked these claims. For police to treat a crowd as a violent mob, he says, is to goad it to act as one. In 2004, Dr. Stott put his eyes into practice at the European Championship held in Portugal, where there were worries of hooliganism, a perennial problem in international soccer. He advised police to embed officers within crowds and have them speak to fans to encourage good behavior. When they do it right, he says, fans will self-regulate and police will have little need for force. Where policing is seen as legitimate, disorder decreases, Dr. Stott says. His advice paid dividends in Portugal. Even hooligans were amenable to police dialogue. Now his methods are standard practice at most European soccer tournaments. They are not common in the U.S., however. Policing of crowds in America is about 20 years behind what it is in Europe, Dr. Stott says. In early 2022, Lieutenant Diamond and then Sergeant Mabry traveled to Europe to learn from Dr. Stott and his network of police contacts. Seattle wanted to create its own dialogue unit. Commander Mabry brought two other officers from Columbus, including Mr. Dyer, who would later become a sergeant, to observe. The trip yielded significant results. When both teams returned, they helped form dialogue units in both departments. 4 months after the trip, Sergeant Dyer was part of the first Columbus Police Dialogue Team. Its officers were deployed during the city's annual Pride March, and for the first time, they wore the now familiar powder blue vests. "I thought my job was to talk to people, so I did," says Sergeant Dyer. "I talked to everyone I could talk to about dialogue." "We took the just-do-it approach," he adds. "If you don't start it, you're not going to be successful." When images of Sergeant Dyer at the Pride Parade spread on social media, feedback was mostly positive. Some of his fellow officers poked fun at him and his blue vest, but leadership welcomed the favorable publicity and was more open to Commander Mabry and his team's innovations. A bigger test came that December when two far-right groups descended on Columbus to protest a progressive church holding a holiday event featuring drag queens. Sergeant Dyer and other officers went to talk to the protesters, some of whom were armed. They wanted to keep these groups a safe distance from counter-protesters near the church, which had canceled its event. Sergeant Dyer's job was to avoid escalation, not to settle a culture war. So when a group of Proud Boys made its way up to the church driveway, he already knew it just wanted to take photos outside the church. It looked like a clash was imminent, one that would require police units on standby to scramble. There were more than 130 officers, including a SWAT team, and armored vehicles ready to intervene. But it was just a photo opportunity, and the Proud Boys snapped a few pics and then marched back to the road afterwards without incident. None of the protesters from either side was aware of the massive police force standing by. That was the first tell. "Wow," says Commander Justin Coleman, who was out of sight directing police operations during this encounter. "This is really a different approach, and this is something that could really work." At the pro-Palestinian protests, the march had begun in earnest to the rhythm of liberation chants, punctuated by occasional horns from passing cars. "Free, free, Palestine," they cry, waving flags and banners. Ahead, the police bicycle patrol is stopping cars on side streets. The marchers are flanked by four dialogue officers who are relaying updates to the commanders. They are also watching for any clashes with either a counter-protester or frustrated driver. There is also an interested observer on the scene. Keeping pace with the marchers and wearing a black leather jacket is Dr. Stott from Keele University. Since the summer of 2023, he's been a visiting professor at Ohio State University and a consultant to the Columbus Division of Police. It appears his approach is working. Since October 2023, there have been more than 50 pro-Palestinian demonstrations held off campus with a total of about 13,000 protesters attending. During this time, police made only 3 arrests despite significant public order challenges, says Dr. Stott. Police also recorded only 2 minor uses of force. So far, Sergeant Dyer has never had to call for backup. We work from the inside out, he says. So if tensions in the crowd are starting to change, we're going to be the first to know. Protesters are about to reach a turnaround point. The pickup truck leading them parks diagonally and obstructs oncoming vehicles. What has been an inconvenience in one direction is now a blockage for both, a potential flashpoint. But Sergeant Dyer has already radioed the command center to explain that this will only be a 5-minute stop to make a few speeches. Then the marchers will head west. Hold back traffic till then, he says. Soon enough, the march heads down a side street. A week earlier, the neighborhood also witnessed a march by a small group of masked neo-Nazis waving swastika flags and chanting racist slurs. When Sergeant Dyer stops to chat with a black restaurant manager during the pro-Palestinian march, the manager is still upset by the neo-Nazi march. Sergeant Dyer tells him that police did investigate and that no laws were broken. We can't stop them coming, he says. They're calling me the N-word. That's what they're saying, the manager says. The word is not hate speech, Sergeant Dyer replies. Hate speech has a high legal bar, and neo-Nazis have free speech rights, too. He wishes the manager well and heads back towards the march. If the Proud Boys rally in 2022 provided a proof of concept for the Columbus police and city leaders, the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee in July of 2024 provided a chance to put dialogue policing on the national stage. Emotions were running high the week of the convention. Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump had survived an assassination attempt just days earlier. City officials were braced for street protests. Police departments from more than 20 states supplied thousands of officers to help Milwaukee's with security, but only Columbus supplied a dialogue team. On day one, Sergeant Dyer and other dialogue officers embedded within demonstrations, talking with protesters, standing between rival groups, de-escalating tensions. Commander Coleman was part of Milwaukee's command center, relaying information from his team. After his unit worked a protest march that took place without any serious incidents, he saw the impression it made on other police. The next day, over the air, we kept hearing officers from other agencies throughout the country calling, asking for dialogue officers to assist them, he says. But the dialogue team's time in Milwaukee was cut short after its initial success. The next day, officers from Columbus's bike patrol shot and killed Samuel Sharp Jr., a homeless black man who was attacking another man. The man ignored calls to drop the 2 knives in his hands. Afterward, Columbus officials recalled all of its officers. A month later, protesters gathered outside police headquarters in Columbus, chanting Mr. Sharp's name and carrying signs, one of which read, "Indict Killer Cops." That protest was led by Aramis Sundiata, executive director of People's Justice Project in Columbus. He has deep reservations about this new method of dialogue policing. His experiences with Columbus police have always been confrontational, and confrontation was often the point. In order to raise global consciousness and force political change, Mr. Sundiata says peaceful demonstrators may find it advantageous when riot police attack them and then make the evening news. You need to think about, how are you really going to push the envelope? Talking to cops is a bad idea, he says. Telling them about your plans and who's in charge is out of the question. When dialogue officers make nice, that can be confusing for folks. The incoming Trump administration, too, seems likely to have reservations about dialogue-based crowd management for a different set of reasons. Given his first administration and his views of street protests, he may push American policing in the direction of more, not less, coercive crowd control. In May 2020, then-President Trump urged state governors to be more aggressive in cracking down on racial justice protests that turned violent. He sent federal agents to Portland, Oregon, to defend a federal courthouse. He has since talked about deploying the military to counter future unrest in American cities. Dr. McGuire, the criminologist, says this creates uncertainty over the direction of travel. The bottom-up reforms in policing in cities like Columbus will run into an external sentiment from the Trump administration to kind of move things backwards. I don't know how that will all shake out, but that's the dynamic we'll see unfold in the next 2 years, he says. Columbus Mayor Ginther, however, says dialogue policing is part of a broader reform effort to create a 21st century community policing organization in Ohio's capital city. You don't get to a point and then rest and think that everything's going to work out okay, says Mayor Ginther. You've got to show continued commitment to change and reform. Otherwise, elements of the old culture will creep back in, he says. Last month, Dr. Stott packed his bags and left Columbus after his visiting professorship came to an end. His next advisory role is likely to be in Seattle, one of the host cities for the 2026 Soccer World Cup. His departure comes at a moment of uncertainty for the Columbus Dialogue team. Despite its promising start, it remains an all-volunteer unit without a permanent leader. There have been efforts to make it a special bureau, but for now, Sergeant Dyer and other officers head the team on 60-day rotations, relying on volunteers to walk among and talk to people in protests. Lieutenant Diamond, the Seattle officer who helped inspire Columbus's innovations, retired in 2023. He now trains other law enforcement agencies in how to use bicycle patrols for crowd management. Amid all the uncertainty in the U.S., Dr. Stott believes the data is clear. The coercive crowd policing of the past doesn't work and often makes tense situations worse. The vast majority of people who attend mass protests do not see police as an enemy, he says. Most soccer fans aren't looking for a fight. Most people at a demonstration want to protest peacefully. Each kind of crowd will respond positively to policing that upholds its right to assemble or express grievances. Then, when force is used, he says, people will see police arresting troublemakers as a defense of those rights, not as an obstacle. Over time, nonviolent movements will begin to self-police their ranks, his research shows. This doesn't mean tensions between police and activists will end. It's not a panacea, Dr. Stott says. You're not getting rid of social conflict. This is a way of managing social conflict to minimize the possibility of major confrontations. You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now for points of progress in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. What this is a map of the world with points indicated on it and a paragraph or two or three or sometimes four describing the point. Number one, United States. Puerto Rico has a new marine protected area thanks to local organizing. The Vega, Baja, and Manati underwater gardens will protect 77 square miles of ecosystems that include mangroves and seagrass beds, part of a safe corridor stretching from Puerto Rico to Cuba. Over a dozen endangered species live in the area, including the greater Caribbean manatee, several species of turtles, and one of the largest assemblies of elkhorn coral in the region. The designation follows a 16-year campaign. We rallied neighbors, knocked on doors, and engaged local and national leaders, said Ricardo Loreno of a local sustainable development organization. Small-scale fishing and ecotourism projects will be allowed to operate, and the coalition is working on a plan for continued co-management. Over 30 marine protected areas, 27% of the waters around Puerto Rico, bring the territory itself close to the international goal of protecting 30% of the world's land and water by 2030, a target set by the Kunming-Montreal Global Biodiversity Framework in 2022. That was from something called Manga Bay and also EcoWatch. Number two, Bolivia. Women-run taxi companies are offering safer rides to wary travelers. Gabrielle Strauss founded Mujeres al Volante, or Women at the Wheel, a taxi service in the Bolivian capital of La Paz, exclusively for women, children, and older people in 2017. The idea has taken off in a country with one of the highest rates of sexual violence and femicide in the region. 38 women work with Ms. Strauss as drivers, including Jacqueline Diaz, who joined the team after her 12-year-old escaped from kidnappers on the way to school. While prices are slightly higher than for regular taxis, riders get customized care. Drivers never leave children alone, even if they have to wait for someone to meet them. A normal driver wouldn't do this, Ms. Strauss says. Other taxi services have since formed, giving women the independence of an income. One company in El Alto, near La Paz, also offers training on the effects of domestic abuse, legal advice, and women's rights. And that was from The Guardian. Number 3, Kenya. Beehive fences are protecting elephants and boosting farmers' income. To prevent human-elephant conflict, conservationists are using fences of live beehives strung between posts to deter elephants, which are afraid of being stung. In a 9-year study across 26 farms in Kenya, elephants avoided farms protected by these fences up to 86% of the time during peak crop seasons. While farmers have to spend some time tending to the beehives, they also benefit by selling honey and wax, and the bees pollinate local plants. Over 14,000 beehives have been installed across Africa and Asia to date. That was from University of Oxford and Mangabe. Number 4, India. A government deal with 30 publishers gives millions of students access to scientific journals. Research institutions cannot afford subscriptions to the very journals in which their scholars publish. Under One Nation, One Subscription, some 18 million students, faculty, and researchers will have access to nearly 13,000 journals for the next 3 years. The $715 million deal, negotiated over 2 years, marks the largest agreement of its kind globally, surpassing similar efforts in Germany and the United Kingdom. Currently, just over a third of India's 6,300 publicly funded institutions have access to some 8,000 journals. Critics say the deal does not address the underlying issues of gatekeeping scientific knowledge, while proponents see it as a way to spur scientific discovery. One study estimates the deal could boost research publication by 38%. That was from something called Science. And the last one doesn't have a number, it just says world. Nearly one-third of the world's regions are growing their economies while reducing carbon emissions. While most research is focused on cities and nations, a study from the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research analyzed 1,500 sub-national regions over the past 3 decades. Together, these areas account for 85% of the world's emissions. The study points to significant decoupling, a term used for economic growth achieved without a corresponding increase in carbon emissions. Europe is credited with consistently outperforming other regions. Without more climate action, fewer than half of the regions are on track to reach net zero by 2050. That was from Science Daily and Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And all that was compiled by Erica Page, who is a staff writer. As I mentioned at the top of the show, science and nature is AWOL, so I will read the explainer in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. It is entitled, Why Does Trump Want to Dismantle the Department of Education? This is written by Jackie Valley, who is a staff writer. A key question heading into President-elect Donald Trump's next term is the fate of the Federal Department of Education, a cabinet-level agency that he and other conservatives have said they want to abolish. Is a dismantling possible? Yes, but Mr. Trump would need congressional approval to eliminate the department. Is it likely? That remains to be seen. Mr. Trump has nominated Linda McMahon, former World Wrestling Entertainment co-founder and president, to serve as education secretary. Meanwhile, Senator Mike Rounds, a Republican from South Dakota, has introduced a bill, the Returning Education to Our States Act, that would abolish the department. This isn't the first time negative headwinds have swirled around the agency. In 1867, President Andrew Johnson signed into law an education department designed to collect data about America's schools. A year later, it was downgraded to an Office of Education because of concerns about how much control it would have over schools. The Education Department, as it exists today, dates back to 1979 when Congress passed a law establishing it. The move followed several decades of expanded federal funding for education, fueled by the Cold War era concerns, as well as efforts to create a more level playing field among students of all races, genders, socioeconomic backgrounds, and abilities. Today, the department's spending totals less than 3% of the $9.7 trillion spent by the federal government at the end of the most recent fiscal year. Ronald Reagan, as president, called for the department to be abolished. His efforts did not gain traction in Congress, though. Now the issue has been raised again. And what follows is a question and answer piece. Question: why do Mr. Trump and some others want to eliminate the Education Department? Answer: during a recent interview with Time magazine, Mr. Trump shed new light on his campaign promise. "We want to remove the schools, or we want to move the schools back to the states," he said. Pressed on what he meant, he explained it would be a virtual closure of the department. "You're going to need some people just to make sure they're teaching English in the schools," Mr. Trump said. "English and mathematics, let's say." The soon-to-be president has essentially described the idea as a fiscally smart move that would pay dividends academically. "We're at the bottom of every list in terms of education, and we're at the top of the list in terms of the cost per pupil. We'll spend half the money on a much better product," he told the magazine. Luxembourg and Norway typically rank at or near the top in terms of education spending. However, the United States does spend more on average than other countries, according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. As for students' academic skills, while the United States is not in the bottom tier compared with other nations, the math results from the Program for International Student Assessment drew particular concern last year. The 15-year-olds in the U.S. who took the PISA test in 2022 performed in the average range, but their scores placed them behind their peers in nations such as Singapore, China, Canada, Australia, and the United Kingdom. Discussion about abolishing the Education Department heated up last year on the campaign trail, especially in relation to Project 2025, the policy blueprint affiliated with the Conservative Heritage Foundation. The project devotes an entire section to the idea of dismantling the Education Department. The policy summary advocates for a state-led educational approach with more parental choice and federal funding in the form of flexible block grants. During the campaign, Mr. Trump distanced himself from the project's controversial proposals, but he has nominated a number of people with ties to it for high-ranking positions within his administration. Already, about 90% of school districts' funding comes from state and local resources. School boards and state lawmakers also largely set the educational agenda by creating curriculum standards and determining how money is spent. Academic experts say they are paying attention, special attention, to the influence of organized political groups as the Trump administration starts making education reforms. "This is not just Linda McMahon executing her version of a Trump agenda," says Jonathan Collins, assistant professor of politics and education at Teachers College, Columbia University. "This is Moms for Liberty at the table. This is parents defending education at the table." Question: what could be lost with a virtual closure, as Mr. Trump has called it, of the department? Answer: the federal government's role in education is, by and large, to provide extra support to states and districts for the neediest students, says Robert Kim, executive director of the Education Law Center. The mission takes shape in many forms. On the higher education side, a sizable contribution is through student financial aid, such as direct loans, Pell Grants, or work-study programs. Those funds support the department's mission of providing equal access to education, giving a pathway to post-secondary degrees for students who otherwise may not be able to afford them. Senator Round's bill proposes moving those programs to the Treasury Department. It's unclear what changes to student financial aid, if any, Mr. Trump would support. The Education Department also puts billions of dollars towards supporting disadvantaged students and children who qualify for special education services. That money flows to states in the form of grants, which are then distributed to local school districts. The Title I grant program, which helps schools serve children from low-income households, is one of the most recognizable examples. Schools use that money to bridge achievement gaps through initiatives such as extended school days, tutoring programs, and mental health support services. Those extra dollars are crucial for districts of every political stripe, red or blue or purple, Mr. Kim says. It can't be stressed enough how it's really a backstop against the effects of poverty and other types of disadvantage. And the final question, does the department have an accountability role? And the final answer, yes. The Every Student Succeeds Act, signed into law in 2015, sets national K-12 education policy and holds states accountable for student performance. But compared with the No Child Left Behind Act, it provides more flexibility for states and school districts to meet those benchmarks. The federal government's oversight of higher education is more indirect. The Education Department approves accrediting agencies it deems worthy of determining academic quality. The department then publishes its list of approved accrediting agencies. Federal student aid can flow only to post-secondary programs, colleges, or universities that have been accredited by nationally recognized agencies. The Education Department also houses an Office for Civil Rights, which enforces federal laws that prohibit discrimination in schools and higher education institutions on the basis of age, race, national origin, sex, and disability. In recent years, the office has seen an increase of complaints filed, 8,934 in fiscal year 2021, followed by 18,806 in fiscal year 2022, and 19,201 in fiscal year 2023. Of course, accountability can't happen without measurable data. That's why another function of the department is to collect information and data, which then informs research and decision-making. The department houses information on everything from test scores to teachers' salaries. And now we've reached the home forum section of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week there is an article and a poem, and I'll read both. And the article is entitled, My Guiding Star? Grace. My challenge is to exude love, to remind myself I wear it proudly around my neck. This is written by Stephanie Wass. 4 years, a pastor at my church distributed star words on Epiphany Sunday, the day my congregation celebrated the Magi following the star to baby Jesus. Each yellow paper star was printed with a word like loyalty, patience, enthusiasm, integrity, humor, and joy. These words were meant to challenge and encourage us to travel more meaningful paths in the year ahead. As I dipped my hand into the word basket, my pulse quickened. I didn't have time for patience or to listen, and words like servant and devotion made me feel inadequate. Pawing in the basket, I searched for an easy word I can handle, like nap, rest, or maybe vacation. The word my hand selected, grace. Slumping into the pew, I shrank into myself. Did this mean God's grace? The love I'd already been given? Or was this something harder, like reflecting His unconditional love by showing it to others? I knew the answer. This was the grace I needed to give, the love I so often neglected to share with the world. The paper star squished in my palm. It would be easy to toss it in the trash or conveniently forget about it. Maybe I could hide it inside my hymnal. I squirmed, twisting my necklace between my fingertips. Like a bolt of lightning, it hit me. A necklace. I could wear the word grace around my neck as a tangible reminder to show others unconditional love. Ordering an engraved pendant online was easy and inexpensive. When it arrived, I secured it around my neck, took a deep breath, and set to work. I started small, letting other shoppers pass ahead of me in the grocery store line and chatting with the checkout clerk instead of rushing through self-checkout. While leaving the store, I slowed to let a car back out of a parking space. I was feeling mighty proud of myself until my good intentions were answered by the angry blare of a car horn. Apparently, the car behind me wasn't happy with my new graceful attitude. I continued with small gestures of kindness, like opening doors, plucking sticks from my neighbor's yard, and complimenting strangers. But these acts felt woefully small compared with the acts of grace I spotted around me, such as my husband driving a church member to a surgical appointment, my sister sending supportive letters and texts to my college-aged daughter, and my cousin caring for her aging parents with unwavering love. Her grace and sacrifice left me in utter awe. "You'll never believe what happened at the garden center," my 90-year-old mother said, her voice popping with excitement during a phone call. I explained to the lady behind me in line that I was buying plants to take to the cemetery. When she heard they were for my late husband's grave, she said she wanted to pay for them. She wouldn't take no for an answer. I touched my necklace. I wanted to exude that kind of love. I felt as if I wasn't doing enough until a conversation clued me in that I might be headed in the right direction. "Oh, so you're going to give her a pass?" a friend said when I answered her criticism of a colleague by reminding her of the woman's many positive qualities. I squeezed my grace pendant, suppressing my tendency to gossip. "Yeah," I said, "I guess I am." "Okay," she responded with a smile. This year, instead of selecting a new star word, I clasp my grace pendant around my neck and consider how I can continue to live into the word. Surely I will fall short. Did I gossip last year, bicker with my spouse, let too many days pass before checking in on my mother and young adult children? Yes, on all counts. Thank goodness for God's grace. But I know I can begin anew each day. This year, I'll inch forward, slide a few steps back, and then inch forward again. It's the forward motion that matters, the knowledge that, with intent, I can move closer to a grace-filled life. Now for that poem, it says, "Pause for Poetry." And this is Backwood Pages, written by Tom Husson. The brambles, once bearing fruit, are shorn to bear thorn. The path is fused by frost. Cold dismisses comforts and entrenches. Water is an ice stone left alone in forgotten teacups, sending black cracks through the china glaze. The 100-pound propane tank, the sentinel stationed in the corner, observes quiet until boughs crack, heavy with snow. Trees resist surly wind and outwait winter, with nut-hard buds dedicated to spring already on the limbs. Icy lace patterns cling to Jaloise glass, melting when wood stove heat reaches the pane. White birch fork under dark, crowd blemished skies. Plump chipmunk gathers seed off the stone wall into its den. Deer consume the cracked corn, wary but hungrily willing, uncertain of their own window reflections. Inside, sheltered from winter's reach, I turn pages, journeying warmly to far places. And finally, we get to the Monitor's View in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. What these are articles written by the editorial staff, and there are two of them, and I will read them both. The first one is entitled, "Votes for Humble Governing." More than 1.5 billion ballots were cast in elections in 73 countries in 2024. If the upshot of that global democracy supercycle can be captured in a single comment, it is this. When you are in power, Polantho Dishotlo, a voter in Botswana, told the Africa Report, "We need to know that you listen to us. You are with us." A year that started with concerns about whether democracy was losing ground to more repressive forms of governance instead revealed a different mood. Not for less democracy, but for democracy that is more effective and accountable. Voters tossed out more incumbents than ever before. Dictatorships fell. A new generation of leaders emerged. The result may be a global turn towards more humility in governing. In South Africa and India, for example, powerful political parties were forced into ruling coalitions. What this election has made plain is that the people of South Africa expect their leaders to work together to meet their needs, President Cyril Ramaphosa said, after his ruling party, the African National Congress, lost its singular hold on power in June after 30 years. Voters wanted change. The party now shares power with a historical rival. In neighboring Botswana, President Masisi said, "We got it wrong, and I will respectfully step aside," after voters ended his party's 58-year monopoly on power. The reality is that in a democracy, the people have the final say, said Lai Ching-te, Taiwan's new president, in his inaugural address in June. I will strive to prove myself as someone in whom you can trust and count on by acting justly, showing mercy and being humble, and by treating our people as family. Even in countries where democracy is a fragile aspiration, leaders have felt a need to soften their hard lines. Upon winning the presidency in Iran in June, Masoud Pezeshkian spoke from the mausoleum of Ruhollah Khomeini in Tehran. Although he was there to renew his loyalty to the founder of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, he nonetheless promised voters, "I will listen to your voices." Humble governing may be a key to rebuilding broken nations. Local elections in Libya in November marked the first step in a tentative process to unite the North African country after more than a decade of divided rule and conflict. The ballot drew participation from 74% of voters. That prompted the head of the Transitional Presidential Council, Mohamed Medfi, to acknowledge the importance of resorting to the opinion of the Libyan people in rebuilding democracy, the Libya Observer reported. By promoting a culture of listening at all levels of society, including the government, media, educational institutions, and the citizenry, we can hope to bridge political divides and move towards a more united and harmonious future, wrote Gayaquang Lee and Rainer Ebert, Africa experts at Yunnan University and Rice University, respectively, in the Cape Argus, a South African newspaper, on December 30th. Dozens of countries will hold elections in 2025. Their voters may note the work already done in renewing democracy through humble listening. And the next Monitor's View article is entitled, "African Art That Liberates." For 4 weeks in November, the people of Senegal and West Africa showed up in droves at sites across the capital, Dakar, to view art. Some waited hours to get into exhibition halls. They flooded social media with selfies, attracting millions of views. This burst of appreciation, particularly among young Senegalese, came at least partly at the behest of President Bassirou Diomaye Faye. "Art feeds our imagination, makes us dream and think. It teaches and educates," he said at the Dakar Biennale of Contemporary African Art on November 7th. "It breathes an extra soul into public aspirations so that they adhere ever better to what we are and aspire to become as people, or as a people." Such sentiments are a sharp contrast to a debate in Africa over what the continent is due for past colonialism and the slave trade. The art festival in Dakar, which brought together the works of some 3,000 artists, invited viewers to confront the past differently. One hall gathered pieces that depicted an alternative history of Africa untouched by colonialism or slavery. Others sought to awaken in visitors a sense of individuality and identity defined by innate dignity and worth rather than by how they are seen by others or what others had done. The event transformed a neglected courthouse that once epitomized the crushing justice of the French colonial empire into a place where we want everyone to feel legitimate, Salamanta Diop, a French Senegalese curator, told the New York Times. The works of African artists in Dakar, the president said, conveyed the pressing need to cultivate peace and harmony among peoples. For young Senegalese, posing gleefully for selfies, they form the backdrop of a future defined by dignity and equality. All right, we still have some time left. Looks like about 3 minutes. I will read from the Global Newsstand section in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This gives you a name of a newspaper, where it's from, a headline, and a paragraph. So here we go. From the Daily Star in Dhaka, Bangladesh, "Rohingya children deserve a bright future." 7 years, writes Raqib El Hassan, an activist and youth leader. That is how long it has been since hundreds of thousands of Rohingya children were forced to flee their homes in Myanmar. In Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh, where more than 400,000 Rohingya children live, basic needs such as food, water, and safety remain constantly at risk. The camps are overcrowded with limited access to essential services. The education they receive is inadequate. As stateless individuals, Rohingya children are denied basic rights, including the right to education, health care, and protection from exploitation. The future doesn't have to be this way. The international community has a responsibility to act. The ultimate solution to the Rohingya crisis lies in repatriation. The time to act is now. Now from the Daily Maverick in Cape Town, South Africa, homelessness needs compassionate, not punitive solutions. Cape Town takes a punitive approach to homelessness, one that fines individuals for sleeping on the streets and carries out illegal evictions, writes attorney Jonty Kager. These measures punish the symptoms of a systemic failure. Chronic homelessness is the result of enduring cycles of trauma, violence, and abandonment. It demands thoughtful, compassionate, if not radical, solutions. But for many homeless individuals, the city's shelters are not a refuge but a place of unease. Residents liken them to prisons where strict curfews and an absence of personal freedom strip away dignity. We must shift from punishment to partnership. Harm reduction and housing first models offer a way forward, one that prioritizes dignity, health, and inclusion. Now from the Sydney Morning Herald in Sydney, commercial logic wins over environmental goals. BP and Shell led Big Oil's push into renewable energy, writes business columnist Stephanie Bartholomew. Now they are leading the retreat. BP announced December 9th that it had sold off its offshore wind assets. Shell has scaled back its investment in renewables. The commercial logic in what they are doing is clear. BP generates returns of 15 to 20% on its fossil fuel investments, but only 6 to 8% from its renewable assets. Plowing billions each year into wind, solar, and hydrogen reduces the returns to shareholders, making them most unhappy. The contest between emissions and returns is one that ultimately shareholders will always win. Now, this was compiled by Nate Engelhart and Jacob Posner, who are staff writers. Well, by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.